Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture. Today's episode, Suspicious Map.
Shall we word?
Shall we word? We really should.
So, I have... Oh, do you mind if I go first?
No, it's absolutely fine. No problem.
So, because I have a story. I have a story about this word. And this story relates to our previous episode with Andy, where you did the word superstitious.
Okay.
And I know you did the word superstitious because I was there for the recording session.
Okay.
And then I listened to it over and over again to edit the episode together and cut it together and, you know, mix it all up and prepare to put it out.
Work your magic.
And I was there for that process too and listened to it probably 2 or 3 times. And then I recorded the little intro snippet and wrote down the episode title and prepared all of the stuff to put the podcast online. As though you had done the word suspicious for some reason. I don't know why I did this. But everything was done. Like, all of the stuff relating to the episode itself was correct. The word superstitious is the one that you did, because that's the one you talked about.
I definitely did do that word.
But in my brain, whenever it came to the title or anything to do with the title of the episode, you had done the word suspicious. And it wasn't until, like, literally the second before I hit, like, the last button I have to hit, I had uploaded the episode, I had done all of the stuff. It was about, like, I don't know, 10 after midnight. So 10 minutes into the Monday where the episode was coming out. And I was about to hit the very last button, and then I went, wait a minute. And I just stared at it for, an inordinate amount of time for how much work I then had to do between, like, midnight and 2 a.m. when I finally finished it.
Oh, dude.
I just looked at it, and I went, what? So anyway, my word this week is suspicious, because apparently I need to do
it
an episode with the word
done.
Suspicious somewhere in it now to get this out of my system. So
you can't argue with the universe like that. You know, it's just
no.
A bad idea.
Like, you know what? Fine. Fine. I will.
Well, this is good because when you said, as though I had done the word suspicious, I immediately thought, I wonder what the etymology of the word suspicious is. So, ask and you shall receive.
Yeah. So anyway, here we are. Anyway. So, you know that phenomenon that happens when you look up a word and it's just sort of, you kind of are left grumbling because the definition includes the word itself or some variant on it?
Yeah, sure.
This word is the king of that thing.
Okay.
Which is a phenomenon that should have a name, but I don't know if it does. Because, so I looked up suspicious, starting with that, because that's the word that obviously I was meant to do. And definition one of in the OED is open to, or deserving of, or exciting, suspicion. And I was like, oh, grumble, grumble, grumble. So then I was like, fine. I looked up suspicion. Definition one, the action of suspecting. Grumble, grumble, grumble. All right, fine.
I have to say, I already hadn't made the link between suspect and suspicion. Because clearly I'm an idiot.
So then I look up the verb suspect.
Okay.
And this one, finally, we get to imagine something evil, wrong, or undesirable in a person or thing on slight or no evidence. Now, this is was sort of interesting because... And the more I dove into this, the more that element of on slight or no evidence is never absent. It's
That's
always
really
there.
That's really interesting.
And it surprised me at first because I hadn't made that connection. Like, I wouldn't have added that as an integral part of the definition.
Yeah, sure.
If someone asked me, what does it mean? I'd be like, oh, you think something wrong or bad about a person or a thing. You might think something bad is on the way. something like that. I think I would normally have it being negative. Like I wouldn't, I don't think I would use the word suspect if it was about something positive necessarily.
I was actually just wondering that too, because I don't think I do necessarily only use it as a negative thing. I would, personally, if you asked me to define the word suspect,
okay,
or indeed suspect, I would probably lean more on the fact that there's a certain amount of guesswork involved, which I suppose isn't a million miles away from on scant or little evidence.
Yeah.
But for me, like, you know, if like I would say, oh, I suspect it's got nothing to do with such and such, or, you know, I suspect right. this word is going to have an interesting etymology. I mean, I'm kind of guessing at that. It may be the case, it may not be the case. Whereas right. I don't know that I would necessarily mean that if I suspect something, that's a bad thing. But I do get that sense. Like, I understand that, yeah, that arguably it's there.
Yeah. I'm curious as to whether or not you would carry that over back through that chain of definitions to words like suspicion or suspicious.
Suspicion or and suspicious are definitely something's up, something funny is going on.
But do you have that? Do you have the negative aspect of that in your head when you do that? Like, is it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, maybe that's where it comes from for me. But I don't think you'd be suspicious of something good. You might suspect something is happening, and that's more of a neutral, sort of value neutral guesswork type of idea. But I don't know that you would be suspicious of something.
No, if you're suspicious, there's definitely a dodginess inherent in whatever it is that's going on.
Yeah. But my first thought was the game Clue, or I guess it's Cluedo.
It is indeed.
Over there. where technically, you know, like if you want to make a guess, you say, I suspect Colonel Mustard in the ballroom with the big ass knife or whatever.
I should point out,
you say accuse.
I've only ever played Cluedo once in my entire life. And it was as an adult because I'd said, I've never played Cluedo. We had it in my family, but as with many other aspects of my childhood, being the youngest of four means that a lot of stuff was just really fucking old by that time. So,
right.
you know, who can be bothered with a fourth child to actually, like, no one taught me to ride a bike until I was 21 years old. I got my first bike for my 21st birthday from my now husband, and then I had to learn how to ride it as a 21-year-old, which, let me tell you, is no joke.
No, I don't imagine it is.
I am still the sort of cyclist who will dismount to ride between, say, a lamp and a fence post.
Right.
If there is a gap that I judge to be not, and by not wide enough, I'm not talking about actually not wide enough. I'm talking about my brain sees two objects, and if I have to ride between them and gauge that might be a dodgy thing to happen, then I will just stop and get off my bike.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, so Cluedo was, I remember it being in a cupboard, and I remember kind of playing with the little weapons because they were slightly odd and cool and funny. It's also, it's a great quiz question to ask people to name all the suspects, all the rooms, and all the weapons in Cluedo.
Yeah.
No one, I say no one, there are certainly people out there, but generally what happens is people can get some, but they can't get the last one.
Yeah, and I think it's the kind of question that if you asked them on a different day, they would also be able to get some, but not
exactly.
the last one, but it would be a different last one left over.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's like naming all the Travelling Wilburys.
Yes.
You always forget one.
I mean, if we're all being perfectly honest, everyone always forgets Jeff Lynne, but...
I don't know. I tend to remember Jeff Lynne because he's the one everybody always forgets.
Oh, maybe he's come full circle.
Because that's the sort of human being I am.
I wonder if this man, the resurrection of Jeff Lynne, the revenge of Lynne. That's good.
Anyway, interrupted.
About suspicious.
You were talking about Cluedo. Clue.
This tangent was my father brought up Clue, but just that idea of there's the idea that if you're not ready to make a final accusation in the game, you have to say, I suspect so-and-so of so-and-so and such, because there's not ample or even sufficient evidence to back something up. Now, that's the definition chain that I went along. So I was kind of suspecting that I was also going backwards in time, which is usually how the sort of chain works when you have to go back to find another definition. I was actually, which is not the case. So the earliest form of all of these different words is the noun suspicion, which is sort of just before the end, right at the end of the 13th century. So 1290 is the earliest thing for that. And then we get the suspicious and suspect, like as in the adjective. That is, the thing was very suspect, you know?
Right, right,
it was
okay.
The scenario was a suspect one or whatever, however you want to word it. And those two are the same year, 1340. And then it's not till 1483 that the verb suspect shows up in writing in English.
That's interesting.
Which is, yeah. One of the things that I've always found weird is that we have in English, we have suspicious and suspect, both as adjectives, both basically interchangeable, but one's just longer. And one's definitely, like, suspicious is definitely more, well, I say definitely. In my experience, I would consider suspicious to be much more common than suspect as an adjective.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So I always sort of assumed that suspicious would have been newer and just sort of did one of those things where it just kind of takes over as a form. But they're actually both super old. Not only did they show up in writing in writing that the OED can find a source for, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
In the same year, 1340, but actually in the very same source.
Oh, cool.
So it's the same book that introduces it. It's Eyenbeat of Inwit is the name of the Middle English work, or Eyenbeate, probably. Eyenbeate of Inwit. I don't know.
I love how to pretend that we know how to pronounce old English words.
It's just fun.
We're totally happy with just giving it a go, you know?
Yeah.
I like to think that there's an expert out there somewhere listening to this podcast and fuming at our bemanglement of the words. But I suppose if you were such an expert, you probably just wouldn't listen to us. It would be too frustrating.
You certainly aren't still listening.
Although, sure. I mean, let's face it, we asked for a cheese expert and lo and behold, a cheese expert appeared.
Oh, that was a great email.
It was so awesome.
Love finding cheese experts. Yeah, if you're an esoteric expert, definitely just email us just to tell us what you're an expert
in. Yeah, we just love to hear that people are experts in you know, fairly niche things.
And also that, was it yours in cheese?
Yours in cheeses.
It was the best email, like, correspondence sign-off I've ever heard. It was incredible.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Yours in cheeses.
But this 1340 work, Eyenbeate of Inwit or whatever, is literally again biting of the inner wit or prick of conscience.
Oh.
So if you have been pricked by your conscience, you have been again bitten by your inner wit.
Which
is much cooler. It makes a lot of sense. So I suppose we should probably get onto the etymology of this word. So etymologically, they all go back to Latin, and it is suspectus, which again means suspected or regarded with suspicion or mistrust.
God damn it! What does it mean?
which in turn comes from suspicere, which means look up at or look upward, i.e. sort of as in to admire or to look up to something.
As in like conspicuous, that same sort of seeing part of...
So yeah, well, yes, we'll get there because conspicuous is to look at together.
Okay. Oh, nice.
Or conspire is to look at together. No, conspire is pretty... Listen, you're confusing me. I started a fairly high level of that, so yeah. But it comes from suspicere, which means look up at or look upwards, look up to admire, but it also has a sense of look secretly at. So like I don't know if it was like a secret admirer type of thing, or if it just always had that sort of side eye, sidelong glance, look askance at type of idea to it.
That's super cool.
Yeah. So the pi root underneath all this is spek, S-P-E-K, which means to observe. And this is where we get a whole bunch of different...
So many amazing cognates.
Cognates. So like spy, espionage, that kind of thing. Despicable.
Spectacle. Oh, despicable. I do love the word despicable.
Look down on.
Here's why I like it so much.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds delicious. It's a good, fun word to say.
Yes.
When my nephew, who recently turned 18 and is now like a real person, when he was around about 3 years old, maybe, strapped in the back of his car seat, I was in the passenger seat. My sister, his mother, was driving, and I was ranting about something. Amy, ranting, you might say. How odd.
No.
I was ranting about something and I used the word despicable. And then later that night, my sister phoned me to say, you'll never guess what the baby has just said. Because he had randomly announced, Auntie Amy say, it's spickable. And I was like, yes, bright young man, he'll go far.
He will go far, that's amazing.
So the word despicable always reminds me of little tiny Luke saying, Auntie Amy say, it's spickable.
Espicable. That's very cool. We also get species and special,
which
is from like a seeing or a form of or a sight of, that type of idea.
I would never have. That's I like that. That I would never have guessed that particular cognate. Cool.
No, I wouldn't have made that leap. And then all the spec words: spectacle, spectator, expect, inspect, perspective, respect, prospect, introspect, and also perspicacity.
Oh, good
which
word.
Is neat. And then the P and the K sounds in spec got swapped around for the Greek side of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us all of our various scope words. So periscope, nice. Telescope, horoscope, all the scopos for to see. Now that one, that train where it goes like suspectus, suspicere, and then to spec, that's all from Etymo Online.
Okay.
I looked up these words in a Latin etymological dictionary because I'm super fun at parties, and it lists... Suspicere, which is the one that comes from, is in Etymo Online. And they list that in a rundown of compounds that are based on specere, just means to see or observe. And it includes a word suspicare, A-R-E ending, mm-hmm. which means to imagine or, you guessed it, suspect.
God damn it, Latin! So, I was about to be very impressed with myself and say that I'm fairly sure from the misty mists of time that the ere ending on a Latin verb is the infinitive form of the verb. But then suspicare is also given in the dictionary as an infinitive form, and I don't recall seeing an ere infinitive. So I'm going to have to go away and find out why A-R-E is an infinitive ending as well as E-R-E.
See, that's interesting. I always, and again, mists of time, Latin forever ago, I always thought that the R-E, like that it could be, the R-E was the important bit of a infinitive.
Maybe you're right.
Ending.
Maybe your mists are less misty than mine.
But knows? I was also... slightly curious as far as why everyone is so sure that suspicere, to see or observe, like to look up to, mm-hmm. is the origin of suspicion and not suspicare, which involves, I mean, A, the word suspect in its definition, but also that sense of imagining.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure why that's not there. Anyway, the point is, this word is always hiding behind itself in definitions, and there's no real idea where it specifically comes from or starts, and that's because it is up to something.
It's incredibly suspect, that, isn't it?
It is a very suspicious word.
Nice.
And again, that onomatopoeia, but for stuff. That's maybe stretching the concept a little bit.
Not onomatopoeia. Yeah, that's... I don't really recall encountering that deal in a dictionary, but I do encounter it a lot with teenagers where you ask them to define a word and they repeat the word and you're like, hold on, do you know what a definition is? And they go, yeah. And you're like, okay, sure. so tell me what that word means. And then they tell you the word again and you're like, I don't think we have a shared understanding here. yeah.
But yeah, so that's... I was weirded out when I just kept seeing it show up in its own definition. I was like, guys, just honestly, stop it.
Maybe the deal is just to keep you suspecting at all times.
I think that's what it is. I think it's a grand scheme. It's basically just lexicographers just messing with all of us.
Conspiracy theories of lexicography. I like it.
Yeah.
It occurred to me this week. You know how well-known billionaire and crazy person Elon Musk reckons we're all in a computer simulation? I was thinking about this. For some reason, I was thinking about this this week. And I decided definitively, 100%, we are not in a computer simulation. And here's how I know.
Okay.
Over the past year, it has become manifestly obvious that collectively, the powers that be of the Earth couldn't organise a piss up in a brewery. Therefore, it seems to me highly unlikely that the project management, the logistics, the budgeting, the actual nuts and bolts of making a worldwide computer simulation happen, it's just beyond us. We just don't play enough together to pull off that kind of... If we could do that, climate change would not be a thing.
No, I think if we are in a simulation, I feel like it's probably... I mean, maybe it's so catastrophically advanced or whatever, but it feels poorly done.
Yeah.
But also, you know, like... And we have, because it's self-contradictory, because people have the ability, and this moment in unprecedented times, blah, blah, blah. In the middle of this worldwide panorama or whatever, it's...
From now on, it will always be the worldwide panorama. Thank you for that.
It's... We are simultaneously, as a species, capable of pulling off a scientific miracle of, you know, finding a new disease and coming up with a vaccine, with several different vaccines for that disease inside of like a year and a half.
Yeah.
Which is astonishing.
It's absolutely unbelievable that has happened.
And also we are capable of producing the kind of quote-unquote leadership that makes that first accomplishment less effective and less sort of worthwhile on the ground because it can't get to the people it needs to get to, but also such an internal contradiction of what people are. So I think paradoxes are the enemy of robots. And so that the self paradox of that means either debunks the whole simulation thing or makes it even more horrifying, because if robots have solved paradoxes, we're just done.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree entirely. I didn't even get into the paradoxical nature of life. I just feel like no one is that well organized.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, in science fiction films where there's a disaster and everything is mobilized in a sensible, honorable, moral way to get over that, like, you know, our politicians took the opportunity to award multi-million pound contracts to chums.
Yeah.
That's useless what they chums. Decided to do. They useless. Not even chums who could actually do the job. Just like, you know, fat bloated chums.
Yeah. I don't actually have a huge problem with, like, there are problems with it, but I don't have a huge problem in the like abstract concept of, like, cronyism and nepotism, as long as it's effective.
Yeah, if you've got a son who is shit hot amazing at running the kind of business that you also own, by all means, appoint your son to lead up your business. But if you've got a useless, driveling fool of a son who can barely wipe his own backside, maybe don't put him in charge of things.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's definitely good and bad cronyism, and bad is when your relationship with them outweighs whether or not they're remotely competent or effective.
Yeah. That's remotely competent and effective is that ship has sailed in British politics. You know, it's if I was of a mind to run for, you know, if I was of a mind to start a political party, please bear in mind that a new political party has been proposed recently in Scotland by former leader of the SNP, Alex Salmond. which I personally have decided is they should have just called it the We White Men in the Huff with the World Party. Because really, that's fundamentally the situation that has led to the birth of this party. Wow. That's a whole other tale. But also, you know, there are a lot of wee white men in the Huff with the World, so they should have just called it that and gone with that particular niche of society. But if it were me, if I was running, if I wanted people to vote for me right now, this would be, in its entirety, this would be my platform. I'm going to find the best people I can to do the important jobs that affect your lives.
Yeah.
That's it. And if those people, the best people, will inevitably get things wrong and make mistakes. And if they get things wrong and make mistakes that cost people's lives and lots of money, then I will replace them with somebody who's going to make fewer mistakes.
Yeah.
There you go. That's it. Job done.
Yeah.
Good people. Good people to do jobs well. That's my slogan.
Nice.
Yep. Ah, cool. Suspect.
Yes.
Suspect, suspicious. Suspicion.
I finally get that out of my brain and get to actually use suspicious in a title, which apparently I was desperate to do last time. An idiot.
Well, I was also kind of given, the word I'm going to talk about, I was kind of given it by the universe too.
Okay.
In quite a convoluted way, because Amy. But we went for a lovely walk last week, starting in the charming little town of Newport-upon-Tay. There are two Newports in the United Kingdom. There's a Newport in Wales and there's Newport-upon-Tay. And Dundee stands on the Tay, the River Tay, which is also a really useful mnemonic for distance, speed, time when you're calculating those things maths or in physics. But Dundee stands on the River Tay. There are two bridges across the River Tay, the road bridge and the rail bridge. And on the other side, you know, you can stand on the banks of the Tay and you can see Newport on one side of the bridge and Tayport on the other side of the bridge.
Okay.
And so we'd gone to Newport. We'd had a lovely walk. And as we were driving home across the road bridge, we can see this vista of Dundee. And the most kind of prominent landmark of that is the Law Hill, which is the highest point of the city. And there's a World War One monument on the top of it. So, you know, the city's kind of built around this hill. So you can see the hill in the middle. And then over to the left, very prominently, is a chimney stack. The chimney stack is the remains of what was once a fucking enormous jute mill complex. So I've talked before about Dundee and jute and that whole historical thing, but the Camperdown Works in the Lochee area of Dundee at one point employed 20,000 people, and it had its own branch of the railway line, and, you know, it was just astonishingly large, this complex. So there's a very beautiful Victorian chimney stack built in red and white brick that's still, you know, it's still standing, and it's highly visible in the skyline. And of course, you know, we're both from here. We've seen this city, you know, we've seen this view a lot, and we can look at things and say, oh, that's this building here, and oh, I never noticed before that you could see this area so well, and all the rest of it.
Right.
So as we're doing that, Ross is driving, I'm the passenger, and I say, what's that? And I point to a landmark that I have never ever noticed before. Huh. And it's a tower or a chimney, something like that, just a long, skinny erection, for want of a better word. And finar. And yeah. I'm looking at it, and I'm, you know, I'm not very good at the spatial awareness, so don't really have a sense of direction in any measure, and right. I'm not always good at finding things. So I assume that I am. This is probably something that I've seen before, but I'm just not putting things together in order to, you know, come to the conclusion of, oh yeah, of course it's that thing. So I ask my husband, who's generally better at those things than I am, and I say, what's that? And he has no idea. And not only that, but we can't quite figure out what area of the city it's in. We can see two landmarks either side, but we're a bit muddy on exactly where it is. So this is the sort of thing that annoys me. And my husband was similarly annoyed. We couldn't find it. So we went home and we looked it up. We tried to find it on Google Maps. In the interim, Ross had gone to see some friends and he'd mentioned this, and they were also curious about where was this tower. So we eventually narrowed it down and we thought we'd found it. Yesterday, we went for a walk. Well, we walked up the Law Hill and then came back down again. And because this tower was fairly close to the Law Hill, we decided to go and see where it was. Because that's the fun times that you avail yourself of in the apocalypse.
Yeah.
So we took a little wander and we found this tower. And it was in one of these kind of, like, you couldn't actually get to it, but you could see it from the street. And you could see that there was a little building attached to it that looked pretty old and quite ramshackle. But it was kind of surrounded by fences and walls, and there was like a little garage and various kind of industrially type units around about it. So in the middle of all this, I'm like, but what the fuck is it? Like, why is it here?
I hope I know what it is.
Like, it's like, you know, it's cool. It's cool that we found it and this is the thing that we were able to see. But what is it doing here? And as we started looking around this little area that we'd walked into to try and get some more, we were like, this is definitely another mill. Looking at the buildings around, like this building here across the street, that's a mill building. You can tell because there's tons of them in Dundee.
Right.
What were you going to say it was?
Well, I don't know if I should. So the thing that leaps to my mind when I think of like a random just sort of chimney type tower, but not in an industrial place, is I learned that a while ago, and I'm now experiencing that thing where you have a thing that you think is a fact until you go to say it out loud and you're like, wait, maybe I'm just wrong about this. But
yeah, I hate that feeling so much.
Yeah. I remember learning about how they used to make shot way back in the day. And like ball bearings and stuff. But lead shot specifically, and it involved a massive tower like that.
Well, there we go. It would seem that it doesn't have anything to do with that. Because what we found was, we found a big building that architecturally, historically, seemed to bear the landmarks of having once been a mill building. Okay. And then across the street and a little bit further away was this tower. Okay. We're like, well, chances are, given that the other random chimney stack in the city is a remnant of a jute mill, and given that there's a mill building right over there, probably this was part of a mill.
Right.
So we get back to the car, you know, our walk's finished. We go for ice cream. Good times.
Nice.
And I come home and I have an afternoon ahead of me where I don't really have a great deal to do. So, of course, to the internet.
Yeah.
So I start off by Googling jute mills in Dundee. That is a rabbit hole and a half because at one point in a single area of the city, it's reckoned that there were 90 mills off a single road.
Wow.
You could drive down that, well, or walk or take a horse down that single road and you would be within sight of 90 jute mills. Like, when you say that Dundee was built on jute, it is no joke to say that the city was built on jute. It's just astonishing. So I do some Googling and I come across a site that says, that's got a list of jute mills. And I find it's very annoying because it's got a map and it's got a number 8 circled on the map next to where this place is. You know, it's identifiable as the same place that we were at that afternoon. And it's got number 8. And then the next picture shows you the entries from like number 30 to number 50 and there is no number 8. Oh. So it's like, oh, kind of annoying. So I do some more Googling of the name of the street and the surrounding areas and all the rest of it. And eventually I find that there is a record of the Law Mill. And the Law Mill is described as a two-story L-plan jute works with dye works to the southwest. The jute works also have an attic and small Italianate tower is situated to the north of Patterson Street and east of Milton Street, formerly Back Street. And I'm like, da-da, this is it. This is our thing. It's obviously, as we suspected, it's part of the jute mill.
Right.
And then this site, this is at Canmore, the National Record of the Historic Environment. It's an amazing website. It's part of Historic Environment Scotland. And it's just so much cool stuff if you're into local history. Which, to be honest, I didn't really think I was, but my God, I spent a lot of time looking at it yesterday. So it points out in this little kind of description of what they know, it points out that the mill is depicted on the first edition of the OS 25-inch map, Forfarshire, 1862 to 1874. Now, do you know what the Ordnance Survey is? It's just occurred to me that, this is a British thing. Yeah, and probably a very particularly British thing. The Ordnance Survey make maps of the British Isles. And, like, the good maps. You know, like, if you want to go walking in the Highlands and you want a map that shows where the big stones are, like, you know, not just where the rivers and mountains are, but, you know, a really, really detailed map, you would buy an Ordnance Survey map.
Really?
And I had no idea that the Ordnance Survey was so old. So this particular survey of Forfarshire, which includes Dundee, was from 1862 to 1874. So, of course, my wandering brain goes, huh, I wonder if I can find that map. So I get myself back to Google. I eventually end up on the National Library of Scotland website. Now, the National Library of Scotland, they're good guys anyway, because they give me the access to OED online that I lost from my local library. But they also have a maps website that has every single one of the maps mentioned in this little survey.
Oh, wow.
So it says it's depicted on the first edition of the Forfarshire 1862 to 1874 map. Then there's a second edition in 1903. Then there's a third edition in 1922 and in 1937. So after quite a lot of searching, because the map site's great but not that intuitive, I find all of these maps. I see how this little mill started off as a series of cottages with ponds, and then the mill buildings were erected and the ponds became cooling ponds for the industrial process, and then it got bigger. And I also discover that the mill was owned by James Neish. And I find out that James Neish was one of the benefactors of the local museum in Dundee, which I find all of this stuff out because I bother to look at a tower that I've never ever seen before. And my God, I have great fun in my geeky little brain. So much fun. Really, really enjoy it. And I don't know about you, but if you come across an old map of a place where you live, you also look to see where your house is.
Right, and, of course.
It's like it's a fundamental human response. So the house that I live in now in Dundee is right opposite a very, very old cemetery. I say very, very old. There are older cemeteries in Dundee, but this one's pretty old.
Okay.
And because the cemetery is marked on all of these maps, all the way back to 1852, you can kind of say, well, isn't it cool? At one point, this would have just been a field. And then you can see over the years, and then this starts to be built and this starts to be built, and eventually these things are going on. What I'm trying to say, Ryan, is I love a map. I love an old map.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just super interesting. It was such a rabbit hole. I was there for hours, happy as a clam, looking at my maps, figuring things out. I was able to find where the mill owner had lived. It was just a few streets down from where the mill was, and the road's still there.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, so I love looking at maps to see changes over time, but I also find it really super exciting to see the things that haven't changed at all. You know,
right, yeah.
150 years ago, more than that, people are still walking down those streets called those names, doing the same sorts of things in those places.
Yeah.
So I started to wonder about the word map because I'd had such good fun looking at maps. And an interesting word, but also a really interesting object. You know, as I'm saying, I had all this great fun just looking at old maps. And it was such a pleasure. I once again had that yay for living in the future thing. To be able to sit in the comfort of my own home and look at hugely detailed 200-year-old maps for free. It's so cool to be able to do things like that.
Yeah.
So I had a look. I had a look at map. And I discovered that, as is generally the case, we've got the verb and we've got the noun.
Right.
And, yeah, you know, we find that they're... And in fact, the verb and the noun kind of... They appear roughly the same sort of time.
Okay.
We've got 1527 for the noun, and then we've got 1589 for the verb. And bizarrely, I thought that the word would be much, much older than this.
I was just going to say, yeah, that is surprising to me, because there were, I guess they would have been called charts, maybe, but like maps existed before that, so
well,
that's really interesting.
I found a super interesting article on the Smithsonian magazine website.
Okay.
It's called From Ptolemy to GPS, The Brief History of Maps. It starts off with several amusing anecdotes of people blindly following their GPS. I don't know if you've... stories like this just, they amuse me so much.
Yeah.
And in fact, I discovered rather pertinently that the Law Hill, this landmark that I was talking about, you know, you can drive up there and there's a sort of a vista of the city and plaques that show you what you're looking at. It's a nice place to take visitors and tourists and things.
Nice.
So this enormous lorry, you know, the kind of lorry that you almost sort of stop and stare at because it's so enormous.
Right.
Took a wrong turn and ended up driving to the top of this hill. It's not a huge hill. And the road just spirals around until it gets to the top. Whereupon he got stuck.
Well, yeah.
Apparently, he hadn't been following a GPS. He had been given directions by a well-meaning passerby.
Oh, boy.
God knows if the lorry driver felt the need to follow that situation up. But
no kidding.
Yeah, I quite love the one. There's an example cited here. In Europe, a 67-year-old Belgian woman was led remarkably astray by her GPS, turning what was supposed to be a 90-mile drive to Brussels into a day-long voyage into Germany and beyond. Amazingly, she just patiently followed the computer's instructions instead of relying on her own common sense until she noticed the street signs were in Croatian. Like, that's some good getting lost.
That is solid. That, yes. That's amazing.
But, according to this article, the oldest surviving map, it's lovely. It says one of the oldest surviving maps is, ironically, about the size and shape of an early iPhone. So there is a clay tablet that they believe to have been created around 700 to 500 BC in Mesopotamia, and it's called the Babylonian Map of the World.
Wow.
And it's just a little clay tablet with Babylon in the centre. And it shows the Euphrates River and it shows the ocean. It names a few regions. It says here, and this is a concept that actually comes up again and again and again when you look at the history of maps. It wasn't really for navigation.
Okay.
So it's believed, scholars think that the Babylonian map of the world was about grasping hold of the concept of the whole world. Like being
right.
able to hold, he's got the whole world in his hands and all that jazz.
Yeah.
And it made me laugh because it made me remember that it says, you know, Babylon's at the centre of the map. Now, in this part of the world, Britain's at the centre of the maps.
Right.
And then when we went to Korea, it took us quite a long time. Obviously, you know, we were in schools to realise that the maps were all wrong. Of course, they weren't wrong. They just had Korea in the middle of them.
Yeah.
And it seemed so bizarre to see that. It really did feel as though the world was different. But I think it's really interesting that, you know, as soon as we have the notion of the world outside our own experience, we automatically as human beings imagine that we are at the centre of it.
Like, yeah.
The world literally does revolve around me.
Well, and it's also just, it's another example, because I had the same experience. It was weird. It was just slightly jarring to see the maps over there, just with their different alignments and stuff. And every time you see a different kind of projection of a map, you get a sense of how much influence the maps you grow up looking at have on you and your worldview. Like this idea... The idea of the problematic sort of Mercator projection where everything in the north is like at the poles is all very hugely skewed, right? And you get this disproportion, you know, Greenland is seven times the size of Brazil according to like just at a glance on these maps. And people, you know, the usual grumpy sector being like, well, why do we have to change the maps? It was good enough for my harumph. And then, but the reality is that it does affect how you think about the world, because that's the way we analogize our place in it. And it's just, yeah, it does, the fact that it's jarring at all to see a map of a different angle or projection or arrangement shows that, I think, which is interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this notion of maps not being for navigation is really, really interesting to me. And I'd better say something about the etymological sense of this word. You know, that's kind of why we're here. But I was really surprised by this etymology, because it feels to me super obvious, but also it had just never occurred to me. So the word map comes from Latin mappa, easy enough,
right,
which means cloth or napkin.
What?
As in the thing that a map would be drawn on.
Right.
A large sheet of something. Because if you want to draw the whole world, you're going to need, unless you're Babylonian, you're going to need a big piece of paper.
Right, yeah.
So Etym Online says that this notion, tablecloth, signal cloth, or flag even, mappa is used to mean all of these words. It's reckoned to be a Punic Semitic word. So in Talmudic Hebrew, you have mappa, which is a contraction of a word menapha, meaning a fluttering banner or a streaming cloth.
Oh, neat.
And the old French gave us map monde, as in map of the world.
Right.
And I believe that mappa mundi or mappa monde is, these are terms that it would be quite niche to use them, but essentially map is shortened from this notion of a cloth of the world, a large cloth upon which the whole world is drawn. And and then the connection between map and napkin also had completely escaped my mind, but they are in fact directly related. I found a wonderful post on Facebook by Etym Online about the word napkin. I'm just going to read you a little bit of this. It says, napkin is a homely little word, but when you unfold it, it's got half a linguistics course inside. It was formed in Middle English from nape, tablecloth, and the diminutive suffix kin. Thus, a napkin is a little tablecloth. So the shift from M to N is a tendency in Old French. So then the nape became a map eventually.
Right.
And this idea, it needs to be a big kind of a big piece of paper or a big piece of cloth. But the word that gives us napkin also, I love this so much. The old French diminutive of nape was naperon, N-A-P-E-R-O-N. This little cloth word also was borrowed into English around about 1300. But in the 16th and 17th centuries, it lost its head. And rather than being a naperon, it became an apron.
Oh, that's awesome.
A cloth to cover things.
That's so fantastic.
Yeah, which hadn't struck me at all. So while we think about maps as being pieces of paper, I certainly do, you know, with those bizarre folds that you can never, ever recreate. It is in fact the case that a map was simply a cloth. And initially, at least, and when I say initially, you know, cartography is reckoned to date from about 15... Well, basically, it's been around for about as long as the word map has. And cartography is a really fascinating... Well, we've established that I like maps. But it's yeah, a really, really interesting subject to look at. And historical maps, and the Smithsonian article says this too, they're as much about looking cool as they are...
Right.
Telling a person where they should go or how they should get to a place. You know, we get maps that perhaps show, here are my lands, but they're about saying, look how mighty my lands are, rather than, if you turn left at the big tree, you'll find yourself next to such and such.
Right,
and again, from the Smithsonian article, I love this. The first great attempt to make mapping realistic came in the 2nd century AD with Claudius Ptolemy. He was an astronomer and astrologer obsessed with making accurate horoscopes, which required precisely placing someone's birth town on a world map. He invented geography, but it was only because he wanted to do better horoscopes, notes Matthew Edney, a professor of cartography at the University of Southern Maine. which is just wonderful. Ptolemy literally invented the word. He coined the term geography, as far as we're aware, the drawing of the earth.
Yeah.
But he had no particular interest in using it for navigation or helping people to find their way. He just wanted to be able to do good horoscopes.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. And you know, the artwork of particularly medieval maps and maps from Islamic countries and maps from the Far East and maps from, you know, that survive from these times, they really do show completely different ways of looking at the world.
Yeah.
Just as you said about that slightly jarring shift of what's in the centre of the map. So, yeah, while we all consider ourselves to be the centre of the universe, we have very different ways at depicting or showing the world that we consider ourselves to be at the centre of.
Oh, that's so cool. There's so much cool stuff in there. Like, I had come up with the fact that Slug started as a lazy person and then went to the animal. And then the obvious question is, well, so what were the animals like? Clearly, well, slugs must have been around before the word for them came up. So what were they called? So I have similar questions about map, because like you say, maps are extant for thousands of years.
I think what we've got here is it's a similar situation to the whole saying that a word has existed for as long as it's been written down is just one way to look at the history of words.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, you're right. Navigation has existed. Navigation is as old as the stars are, you know?
Yeah.
But when did people start actually using cloths or pieces of paper or you know, recorded fixed systems to complete the process of navigation?
Yeah, I guess.
Did they do that? You know, did they draw constellation maps? Did they draw pictures of their... It's such a fascinating subject, because it's like if you give a little kid paper and crayons, then invariably they will draw their house.
Yeah.
And homes are obviously important. So, and that fundamental instinct that I mentioned, where you go, oh, where's my house on this map?
Right.
Can you see my house from here? I think, yeah, we all kind of want to know where our place in the world is. And we don't necessarily need a large piece of cloth or paper with that information drawn out on it to know where that is. But I'm really glad that people started writing this stuff down, because it meant that I could enjoy a very geeky, esoteric afternoon yesterday. But
yeah.
Also, there's just so much cool information in maps.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, the other element of it, of the whole first written use as opposed to first use and stuff, is... I guess it's entirely possible that nobody had the need. Like, maps might have existed and probably had a name and could even have been called maps for a long time before anyone bothered to write it down, because the idea of writing about maps, I think, could conceivably have been... Like, that's... Writing about maps is a lot less useful than maps. So... Maps could exist before the word map needs to be written down. So maybe, I'm twisting myself in knots. Also, I love that apron is like orange, in that it's one of these, like, a word that started with an N in the beginning, and then the indefinite article just kind of yoinked it from it.
Yeah, it really is. It's a lovely little post. It's the Etym Online post describes it as, the process is known as faulty separation or misdivision.
And
also lists adder and umpire as examples of that. And nadder, the snake. I didn't know about an umpire. I wonder if numpire has anything to do with numbers. I don't know. That just occurred to me there.
Huh. That's really cool.
But yeah. Math.
Cool. I also want to, just because I realized that I... sometimes get slightly irritated when I hear people like make one half of a mention of a little factoid or trivia bit. The process going back to the tower that used to make ball like lead shot.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
Why
tell
they needed
me about
a tall
that.
Tower. What I was told was what they would do is go up to the very, very top of the high tower, because the idea of making something spherical is it's tricky to make
sure.
a ball out of, especially out of something like lead. Like, how are you going
to
do that?
But apparently they have to drop it from a great height.
They would drop molten lead from a great height, and in the process of falling, it would fall in droplets, which are round.
Oh, that's amazing.
And the air would cool them off, so that by the time you dump them at the top of a really high tower in molten lead form, and by the time they hit the bottom, they had both formed into droplets and cooled and hardened into lead shot at the bottom
of it. That's amazing.
And that's why they needed those big shot chimneys or whatever they were called. For making lead shot.
Old timey science and engineering really is super cool.
Yeah.
Like there are so many things that we do nowadays that rely on technology that we don't even consider to be technology. But
someone
had to figure that shit out, you know? How did that happen?
Yeah. It's the sociological equivalent of watching a kid learn what hands are. like a baby when they don't know what their hands where or what their arms are for or where even they are, and they keep like smashing themselves in the face and then looking at it being like, what is this thing? When you watch a human work out, what feet are is like, that's I think the same thing, like this idea that even these really basic, you know, rudimentary things that are, yeah, like you say, you don't even consider them inventions.
And you know, it fits with knowledge too, you know, like thinking about cartography. The first people who measured the circumference of the Earth had absolutely no way of knowing whether or not they were correct. other than you know the mathematical principles that they were basing this on.
Yeah.
But they were pretty much, I mean, spot on is a difficult term to use when you're talking about the circumference of a planet. Obviously, it's, you know...
Yeah,
it's a tricky measurement, but they weren't far off. You know, the kind of better, more modern, more technologically informed ways that have been used to make that same measurement since then, basically say, oh yeah, pretty much what those guys said.
yeah.
And you're like, yep, they had sextants and, you know, numbers and shit, and we have lasers in space.
Yeah, but, it was like, to figure out what they did in like whatever it was that. 8th century BCE or whatever, when they figured out that A, the Earth was round, and B, here's exactly how big it is.
Yeah.
It took us sending satellites 30,000 kilometers away into space and then looking back being like, yep, story checks out.
It's just wild.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool.
Anyway.
What a suspicious map.
Suspicious map. There be dragons.
And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. To get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.